Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Defying odds is a term that is used a lot to describe someone who overcame adversity and accomplished something extraordinary. But those two words may fall short when it comes to our first guest. Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao is a few months into leading one of the largest cities in California. At 38 years old, Mayor Tao is the first Hmong to lead a major U.S. city. Born and raised in Stockton, Tao's family shares a history of becoming refugees, escaping genocide during the Vietnam War. An American story that includes overcoming poverty, domestic violence, and homelessness before becoming Oakland's 51st mayor. But Mayor Tao's inspirational story is among growing political representation for Asian Americans. And that topic is part of Cap Radio's new podcast, Mid-Pacific, which explores Asian American identity and the feeling of being between two worlds. Mayor Tao joins us to share how her Hmong American and Asian American journey shaped her approach to leadership. Welcome, Mayor Tao.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start before you were even born, because we are often shaped by the generations that precede us, especially when it comes to our parents. How did your parents' journey to the U.S. and California shape you?
You know, it's very interesting. Growing up, they didn't even talk about, you know, all of the things that they had to go through. It was actually not until I was at UC Berkeley, and I decided that I really wanted to understand better through their lens all the journey that they went through escaping genocide. And so I kind of lied to them and said that I had this book report and that they, you know, and I had to ask them all these questions. And so that was when the first time I realized that there was so much trauma that they had to go through, right? And so for my mom, so the Hmong people, they live in the mountains of, majority of them live in the mountains of Laos. And my parents, my father was an orphan, and he lived on a different mountain relative to my mom. And my mom was what you would consider a little bit wealthier in the sense because she had family. And Hmong people, they live off of the land. And so with that being said, my mom was pregnant when the war started, and she had also had an infant. Her first husband died in the war, and she had to escape. And the stories they told about how so many mothers had to feed their babies opium so that they would not cry while trying to run through the jungles to escape genocide. And sometimes giving a little bit too much opium and the babies would never wake up. And it's heart-wrenching, right? It's heart-wrenching to see that so much death was actually their reality because of war and what war did. And so, you know, my mom, she was shot in the arm. She still carries that bullet in her arm to this day. My parents, you know, my father, his journey was a little different. He was an orphan. And so he knew how to swim, and he swam a lot of people across the Mekong River so that they could get to the Thailand refugee camps. And so my parents did meet in the refugee camps, and, you know, it wasn't love at first sight at all. It was more of a survival technique where the community said, look, you're an orphan, and you, you know, to my mom, you know, you're a widow with, you know, now two infant children and your mother-in-law, you both should just get together, become a unit, and go to the new world and try to survive and make it. And so that's the story of my parents and how that shaped me growing up. It was that, you know, there was not a lot of lovey-dovey, you know, romance going on with my parents, but it was just a sense of survival the whole time. Now that I understand the relationship a little bit better, but, you know, it worked. And over time, they learned how to be best partners to each other in that sense. But, you know, and then for my father, being an orphan and coming to the United States, really demasculating what he can do to provide for his family, being that he couldn't speak the language, didn't have any skills, trades, or the, you know, no one was formally educated. My mom is illiterate. She can't even read the Hmong language because the Hmong language is just heaven. It's a new language that was actually produced by missionaries. And so, you know, so it was difficult growing up because their frustration, of course, with 10 children too, you know, sometimes we got the brunt of that frustration.
Yeah. I would imagine, given that you learned that as a young adult, as a college student at UC Berkeley, that must have deepened your own understanding of your own childhood.
Absolutely. It, you know, for a very long time growing up, I did not feel loved, and I did not feel as if my parents were the best parents, you know, and no one's perfect. But, you know, as a young adult, I didn't realize that it was all this trauma, right? We talk about PTSD all the time. We talk about intergenerational trauma. Imagine going through genocide, running in the jungles for your life when you can only run at night, because if anybody saw you in the daytime, they would shoot you dead on sight, and then seeing death everywhere, and then crossing the Mekong River, which is Russian River, and then living in a refugee camp, you know, not knowing where you're going to be actually planting your roots, then coming to a new world where you don't even know the language, you're seeing people who look different outside of what you are used to seeing for the first time. You know, I remember a story where my dad said, you know, he saw the first Black person ever, the first Latinx person ever. And I asked him, you know, how did you feel about it? He was like, well, I felt like they were the same as we were, because for whatever reason, they were all in the social services line with us. And we just had a sense that there was white superiority, because it was mainly people who had color on them that were in these lines. And so, you know, it was difficult growing up, but then in hindsight, it's like, now I get it. I get it. They never got treatment or was given services for their PTSD, even to this day, right? No one said that they, you know, my parents said no one actually came to say you could go get an education. So the assumption was we have to, you know, my mother had to be a stay-at-home mom. And so it's so much more that the government could have done. Mm.
When you arrived to the Central Valley, to Stockton, were you surrounded by a Hmong community growing up, or was it just you and your family, and a large one at that, 10 children?
So I was actually born and raised in Stockton, California, and my parents actually, my father, all I can remember was growing up outside of the Hmong community. We lived on the outskirts of Stockton, away from the Hmong community, and I remember early on my father saying that was because he saw other young Hmong boys join gangs to help, you know, find some semblance of family and identity in this new world called the United States of America. And so my father moved us out into a predominantly white neighborhood so that my brothers wouldn't join the gangs. And so, you know, I could see a little bit of a heartache in my dad today because we were not born and raised around our, you know, other Hmong families. You know, we didn't grow up having a lot of Hmong friends. And so all of my siblings and I, we don't have strong ties outside of the Hmong community, outside of our relatives, right? And even then, you know, my first cousins, they don't live here in California. The majority of my first cousins live in France, because that's where they were shipped off to. So they're, you know, and so we're not really, we're close as much as family can be, but, you know, they live in France, and without being able, growing up my whole life poor, and there, I assume they didn't grow up with much either. We didn't really, you know, we can't just pick up and say, let's go visit our cousins.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that story resonates with a lot of people who have a family story of immigration and leaving their homeland for a safer life. Given that as you got older, your teenage years into young adulthood were difficult, to say the least. How were those initial years when you moved away from your family who lived in Stockton to the Bay Area? How did that shape you?
Yeah, you know, like I said earlier, I felt like I, you know, I just knew that, you know, how I was being treated at home, I didn't like it. I didn't like the fact that it was so gender-based. You know, the patriarchy within the Hmong community runs really deep. In hindsight, you know, my parents were raising their kids the only way they knew how, you know, the way that it worked in the homeland. And so I was a little bit rebellious in the sense that I demanded that if my brothers weren't going to wake up at 6 a.m., which was required of any of the daughters to cook and clean, then I wasn't going to do it either. And so I was rebellious since an early age. And so when I left the house because, you know, of what I felt was emotional abuse and sometimes physical abuse, you know, I left because I was also trying to find, you know, who am I, right? I'm at home, I'm Hmong. And then you know, when I go to school, I'm this Hmong American person. And what does that mean? And so when I left, and, you know, I couch surfed, and I, you know, one of my girlfriends, I remember her mother just up and left and went back to Cambodia. And so she was living in Section 8 housing, and she just had the home to herself. And so that's where all the kids who kind of wanted to leave their house kind of hung out, but we still went to school. We parented each other. And then from that point, moving to the Bay Area, after graduating high school, you know, I was in a relationship with my son's father, and that was quickly, you know, it wasn't like 3 months in, and I was in a, you know, what I didn't know then was I, you know, was a domestic violence relationship. That was my very first serious real relationship. And so,
and you were pregnant at the time, correct?
Well, no, I was with him for about 4 years, and then I became pregnant. And when I became pregnant, it you know, so I was with him for 4 years, 6 months pregnant. I still remember that day so clearly. He grabs me by my hair while I was sitting on the bed and pulls me down. He was upset that, you know, he was going to go out, and I don't know what he was going to do. And so I asked him to stay, and he wasn't happy about that. So he pulled my hair and dragged me to the floor, and he just started kicking me, you know, and I was 6 months pregnant with his child. All I remember was protecting my stomach and just begging for him to leave. I'm like, okay, just go. And then he left. And that was when I realized, like, you know what, like, I don't want my son, my unborn child, to grow up this way. And by that time, you know, in any abusive relationship, of course, I don't have any more friends. My family has been cut off for many, many years. And so I was 20 years old and feeling very shameful and embarrassed, because I felt like I chose him over everybody else. And so how can anybody, you know, how dare I call anybody for help when, like, I chose this man, right? And quite honestly, I thought I was in such a unique situation, you know, being a 20-year-old. And I was embarrassed of the situation, because here I am, this rebellious, strong young girl who's like, no, you know, break the patriarchy. And, you know, was like president of the Key Club, which is a service club, for years in high school. Like, how do I get into this situation? And anybody can, right? And so, with that being said, you know, I left, and I didn't have a place to live. So I was, again, couch surfing wherever. I mainly lived in my vehicle. I gave birth at the county hospital, where, you know, I got a car seat that was donated. I still remember to this day, the car seat was one of those very hard plastic old car seats. And I was just so happy that somebody would give me a car seat. And then even then, I had to ask a stranger to take me to someone that I had met's house. And then from there, you know, I remember the nurses being really concerned about the fact that they saw nobody come and visit me. And they kind of followed me around for about 2 weeks. And it was truly the nurses who taught me how to breastfeed my child, how to bathe my child. And, you know, a 20-year-old mom, you need a lot of support and help too, you know, and so and made sure that I had the mental capacity to do it. And so I don't know how those, you know, if it was in their work description, but I'm just so thankful for those nurses. And I can't remember their names at all. I wish I could, but it was also through donation of retirees who were knitting clothes for babies. I used those clothes, and I still have them to this day. And so, you know, it's small things like that that really goes a long way. And people don't understand how, you know, that it goes a long way for those who are needing.
Yeah, I mean, when you say it goes a long way, I mean, you went from those experiences to attending community college with an infant. You traveled to transferred to UC Berkeley. You became a city council member eventually, and then now you're the mayor of Oakland. And these experiences have become formative in your policies. But how do you feel your immigrant story and your racial identity has played a role in how you've come to this mayoral seat and what you want to accomplish?
Right. I mean, you know, if I can just talk about getting into politics, you know, it was just, to be honest, an accident in that sense. I was actually I was a legal studies major, and I was headed off to law school. That was the plan, but I couldn't afford to pay for my son's clothes, as he was outgrowing it so quickly as a single mom at UC Berkeley. And so, you know, I took on this internship through this program called APAPA. APAPA really tries to get APIs into local government and do exactly what I'm doing today, is get into politics. I was not thinking about politics. To be quite honest with you, I had no clue clue what the word politics really meant. I didn't even really know what local government really did. You know, I think we had a one semester of lessons, like, I don't know, maybe middle school or high school. And so I took the internship because they paid me $1,000 and I needed it. And they paired me up with the Oakland council member at large. And that's when I realized, like, oh my goodness, all of these policymakers who are creating policies for everyday people, working people who have no time to show up to these council meetings that they have every Tuesdays and Thursdays, that we have to live by those, you know, those policies and those rules. And yet they have no live life experience. How would they know the negative consequences that they are creating through what through the policies that they're implementing, which looks good on paper, right? And so that was the start of like my passion for this is, you know, I need to be here to advocate for those who live who are living on the margins, because I also knew that going to law school, I was never going to like actively go to court to practice law. Because I didn't want to be the change factor after the fact. I wanted to be the change factor in the forefront. And so when I jokingly say when I met local government, you know, I knew that that's where where my passion is. And so I started off as a staffer, and I never knew that and never thought and dreamt that I would ever be an elected official, because I didn't see elected officials that looked like me, right? At the time, I was still a single mom, barely making rent as a city staffer, barely making rent. And to me, an elected official comes from money. To me, an elected official is more privileged in the sense of their skin tone, right? Looks a lot whiter than my skin. You know, an elected official is somebody who understood, you know, and understood politics and government inside and out, and have been studying it for decades. That's all what I thought an elected official is. And so, you know, to run in 2018, I did, you know, for the first week, try to be a politician. I fell flat on my face. I don't know what I was trying to do. And then I just looked at myself in the mirror and was like, Shang, you know what? You've come so far. Like, who gives a damn? Like, go and be you. Go and be you. And if they like you and they know that you can advocate for them because you've been advocating your whole life, then they would pick you to represent them. And that was actually when I fell in love with myself. When I fell in love with myself was when I was so true and so raw. I started talking about my DV experience. And, you know, men came up to me and said, well, you shouldn't talk about that because it makes you look like you're asking for, you know, sympathy. And I'm like, well, then in that case, don't vote for me. And number two, I'm going to keep talking about it just because you, a man, had told me that. And for every man that told me that, I had like 10 more women who said, hey, I'm going through the same thing, or I've gone through it. You're an inspiration. And so for me, how that shaped, you know, being an API woman and a Southeast Asian woman, being the first Hmong, now the first Hmong mayor of a major city, it's huge. And this is what representation means, right? I got it wrong the first time around. Right. The first time around of like, oh, well, it needs to be a privileged person. No, absolutely not. Our elected officials need to have lived life experiences. They, you know, that's how we create impactful policies, because I'm a true believer of lifting from the bottom up. And so, you know, if we can lift from the bottom and make sure that those who are living on the margins have a better quality of life, we're all going to be better for it.
Mayor Tao, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was a wonderful way to end. That is Oakland Mayor Shang Tao, who is the first Hmong to lead a major U.S. city, sharing how her family journey fleeing genocide during the Vietnam War and her own personal journey of overcoming domestic violence and homelessness has shaped the mayor's approach to leading one of the largest cities in California. You can listen to more of Mayor Tao and other Asian American leaders in today's episode of Mid-Pacific, Cap Radio's new podcast hosted by Sarah Mises Tan, which explores Asian American identity and the feeling of being between two worlds. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.